Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and for this edition we've got something a little bit special for you with a very, very special guest joining us. Before I introduce you to our special guest, first of all I will just introduce my co-host for this one, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Stu, and I'm looking forward to this one, mate. We're looking at something that's a real growing trend in football, and something that, you know, we at These Football Times want to recognise and acknowledge and promote as well, because it's a massive thing going forward in football.
It is. It absolutely is. And I think, you know, really few football fans would dispute that there's been a very prodigious rise in the popularity of women's football over the last decade or so, with the recent Women's World Cup tournament in France achieved unprecedented media coverage, and with so many of football's major clubs now having women's teams as an inherent part of their setup, there seems little doubt that the trend is set to continue. So today we're going to look at the state of play in women's football, and like I said at the beginning, Gary, I think we've got a very special guest with us tonight.
Absolutely, mate, and I think it's important that, you know, at such times as these that we get an expert on board with us to talk about the subject, and we can find no better person to throw a few questions at than the co-founder of the Offside Rule podcast, Lindsay Hooper, as well as her work alongside Kate Borsey and the team at the Offside Rule podcast, who provided fantastic daily podcasts about the Women's World Cup 2019 in France. Lindsay is a broadcaster journalist and presenter working for, amongst others, such august bodies as the Premier League and BBC. And she spent to the recent tournament journeying around France with the Lionesses. So, obviously, the perfect person to talk to about the World Cup and its impact. And also, any listener to the TFT series of podcasts will also be well aware of Lindsay's voice, as her is the wonderful fluid tone that introduces each and every podcast that we do. So, hi, Lindsay.
Hello. Hi, Gary. Hi, Stu.
Hi. As Gary said, hopefully your voice will be instantly recognisable to the regular listeners.
From that very short spurt at the top of the podcast, yeah, maybe.
I'll tell you what, I think I probably, when I'm editing it, I'll probably hear more from you than I do my own family.
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. Like I say, I'll probably listen to you a good two or three times a week, to be fair.
That's more than my mum as well.
Like Gary said, you know, Gary and I, the reason why Gary and I do this, and Stephen to a certain extent as well, is we love to learn, we love to speak to new people, you know, we love to talk about football, and clearly, you know, women's football is something that has very much been to the forefront this summer, and, you know, and Gary's right, we always try and get in the experts. You know, Gary and I and Stephen have never professed to be experts in any subject. We're just incredibly interested in every subject, I think it's fair to say, Gary.
Absolutely, buddy, yeah.
So as you're the resident expert tonight, Lindsay, I'm pretty sure there'll be, you know, a few questions coming your way. Just to warn you, my brain does tend to go off in tangents, because with me just sort of hosting it, Eugene, asking a few questions, my brain is always working overtime as people say things, which will trigger the most random thoughts and questions. So, like,
that's,
I say,
okay, I'll try and keep up.
You'll be able to keep up. It's just whether or not you might think, oh, that was a bit random and a bit strange, but that's just kind of how I am, I'm afraid. But like I say, we'll be fine.
Okay, so perhaps it's worth, just as a kickoff, Lindsay, so just to ask you how you describe the state of the game before the Women's World Cup in France, and how perhaps the profile has been changed by the tournament.
Sure. I mean, I think, first of all, it was a bit of in a state of flux, because I think if you look across the world, assuming as we're talking about a World Cup and the effect that a World Cup tournament has had, I think we have to address the world as a whole beforehand. And I think it was definitely fluctuating between Europe and the rest of the world. And I think that highlighted as well within the tournament itself. But you had nations like Italy and Spain that were investing a lot in women's football in the build-up to this tournament, and they certainly reaped the rewards of it. And we'd had countries already like England and the Netherlands that had already ploughed quite a lot into it. Germany and France had already been front runners, and then countries like Australia that take women's football really seriously, along with the favourites going into the tournament that eventually won it, the USA. So it was really sporadic if you take a measure of the whole globe of football, because a lot of parts of Africa, they're probably really still developing it. And we saw a lot of that, I thought, within the England-Cameroon game and bits that came out of that match. Talking points that arose from it, perhaps, which we didn't want to be the talking points, but I think really were key ones to have afterwards as well. So I think European-wise, women's football was certainly on the rise, but nobody expected that it would have the pickup and the viewing figures that it had in some countries. And then you look at places like Brazil, which had record viewing figures, England, where the semi-final with USA smashed all records ever seen before with those BBC figures. And there is a lot going on in the game right now, which is exciting, which is bringing it to the forefront, well overdue in my mind. But the tournament, I think, will be a turning point in a way, although I think Canada 2015 probably was another turning point too. It depends on which country you're in.
Yeah, I think you're right about the Canada was probably the turning point, and perhaps France was just a massive added momentum to the progress of the game. And it seemed to me that the development of the women's game sort of echoes how the men's game developed as well, because that was a sort of less than even development across different areas of the globe. And perhaps it is slightly different with the Americans obviously being quite prominent in the women's game, but it's not necessarily an even development across the globe, is it?
No, not at all. And I think that's the thing that needs addressing next. You know, probably off the back of this tournament, we're going to see for the next World Cup changes happen where more teams will be introduced. I think there's already talk of it being maybe reached and expanded to 32 teams to take part. But what that throws into it is the question of the standard of those teams that are able to come in, and whether their own individual football associations and governing bodies are really financially backing the teams to do so. You know, there were huge stories around this World Cup that's just gone in France, one being around the Argentina team and the fact that up until fairly recently into the tournament, they'd had to self-fund and sometimes even sleep on coaches and all sorts to be able to play the game. And unfortunately, I think when you're trying to grow and expand something and do it for the better, those stories are going to come along again, because you're going to have to break down all those barriers that for other countries have taken, you know, decades to break down. And one of the other things I wanted to point out was that, you know, apart from the Thailand, the 13-0 thrashing they had from the USA, across the board, the standard and the gulf between teams, I thought, had narrowed a lot. But of course, if you broaden this out again and you try and include more, which it has to happen and that should happen, we want to see the world playing football, not just a few countries and niche and richer ones at that, then you're going to have that differential for a while as well. So I think if it does expand, I think people who've liked watching it have got to sort of get their heads around the fact that you're probably going to get lesser nations coming in to begin with that are trying to find their feet, and that will be reflected in scorelines again.
Absolutely. And the early World Cups, but in the sort of 60s, in the men's World Cup, you had similar sort of games where lesser teams were sort of being trounced by the more traditional forces, but they progressed, and I'm sure that would happen in the women's game as well. Do you think that's probably the case?
Exactly, and we've seen it over the years. We saw it in the men's game, and we've certainly seen it in the women's game. And the fact of the matter comes down to professionalism in the sport, doesn't it? So when you've got nations that are training full-time, have got full-time wages, have got financial backing, have got facilities, which is also really important, then you see that in the product on the pitch. But of course, there are nations that don't have those luxuries. They don't have the benefits of having a full-time wage to even do it. They don't even have brilliant facilities. So I think until there's that level playing field, which everyone's always trying to get, but I think we're still aspiring to that in certain parts of the men's game as well, to be honest. then it won't ever be a completely true level playing field. But maybe that's the thing that we should always be pushing for anyway.
It's funny, I mean, if you don't mind me asking, obviously, you know, you mentioned the Thailand result and you mentioned the Cameroon performance, and you mentioned, you know, the desire to increase the Women's World Cup, you know, and absolutely rightly so. But I think also, and you know, you mentioned finance, and I think FIFA has a massive responsibility and a great opportunity at this very moment to really develop the women's game, but to develop it globally, you know, as a whole. You know, if they're looking to increase the size of the tournament, then they also have a responsibility, like you say, to make sure that teams who are arriving to play in these tournaments are not, you know, are going to sort of perform on the world stage, they're going to contribute to the tournament and are not just there purely to make up numbers. That, you know, FIFA really has a massive responsibility, I think.
Huge, yeah. I mean, the main thing being that they need to ensure that the infrastructure is in place within these countries and within these governing bodies to be able to help that those teams progress. Because what nobody wants to see is I highlighted the Cameroon match because that's probably quite clear in people's memories of different bits that happened throughout that game. And if that was to happen again next time around, then nothing's been achieved, nothing's gone forward. But hopefully there is an education around it as well and a responsibility, like you say, from FIFA that they can implement so that they will improve and they will understand more. I felt like, certainly within that match with England, that there was a real lack of understanding there around the rules, to be honest. And I feel that that might be because that's not being properly explained. And although everybody says, oh, you know, everybody gets a copy of the rule book, so to speak, and, you know, has that been related on a football pitch, on a coaching schedule? And my gut reaction from that was probably not, considering what the Cameroon coach was saying in the press conference afterwards.
It's very difficult for you to answer this question, and I appreciate that, but do you get a sense of FIFA, you know, really wanting to drive women's football forward and, you know, really wanting to see this spread of the women's game right across the globe? Or do you feel it's not so much lip service, but there is a real genuine desire to promote the women's game?
I think they do want to do it, but I also think that they need to be seen to be doing it too. So it sort of ticks both boxes. Whatever you're looking at the moment, where there is a real push forward, certainly for women in the workplace, whether it be gender, whether it be looking at other communities like LGBT+ and different things, I think there is an obligation there now. And that I think that it's great that there is, because that's the only way that you bring things to the front of people's mind and that you actually re-educate society as well. And FIFA have already managed to achieve so much with the Women's World Cup in France, because the viewing figures alone and the fact that it's had people that watching women's football that perhaps weren't open to watching it before, that didn't think it was very good, that didn't think... I mean, let's go back to it, even in this country, in England, because it was banned for 50 years by the FA. It was actually told to society that it wasn't for women and that they shouldn't be doing it. So to actually go back on those sorts of stances and to redress the balance and to actually break down those barriers again, it takes so much time and effort. But something like a World Cup goes such a long way, and in terms of financial backing as well. You know, the next thing that needed to come in women's football was sponsors, and it needed to come in brands and advertising and people wanting to actually back the sport. And if you've got it on the biggest stage, which is the World Cup, then that does follow, and you are starting to see that that's how it filters through.
You make a really good point there, Lindsay, about the ban, the FA ban, because obviously in the men's game, England and Britain were the pioneers of football in the men's game, but the women's football was almost seen as like very much like the reserve army of labour in the industries when wartime, when women were encouraged to go into factories, but after the war go back to being the housekeeper and that sort of thing. And that ban between 1921 and 1971 obviously put a massive break on the development of women's football in the UK, and it obviously must be a real difficult thing to... So from 1971 to where we are now, I mean, it sounds like a bit long period, but it's less period than the time that was lost between in that 50 years of the ban.
And also it is the timing. It's when it happened, not only for how long. Off the back of wars and off the back of different things globally that had happened that had meant that women had had more responsibility back at home and on the home front than they ever had before. And actually they were doing fine. And that was really apparent in football because people were watching it and people weren't saying anything about it being bad. And maybe that scared a few people in the higher positions of the FA back then. And they then issued this ban and that it wasn't allowed and that they deemed it as not really ladylike, which, of course, you know, when we talk about gender stereotypes nowadays, seems ludicrous.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to say, it's funny, Lindsay. I mean, where I work, we teach, we've just written a new sort of football degree, football coaching degree, and one of my sort of passions in, you know, with regards to football is its societal impact, the culture it has, not just on this country and worldwide. And my cohort of students this year could not, because we look at the history of the game in this country, and they could not get their head around the ban on women's football. You know, they had no idea there was a ban on women's football. You know, even the fact that it was in place was news to them, let alone that, you know, we're now sort of trying to fight to almost reintegrate women into football and, you know, and create equality within football. They were oblivious to the ban, and it's almost, you know, I've just mentioned their FIFA and their responsibility, but I think, you know, the FA also have a responsibility to, you know, to really sort of make up for the damage that was inflicted on the women's game.
And I think they have been. I mean, the thing is, they're making up for actions that were so detrimental that it's difficult to make up as such. But, you know, what I can't do is fault the current staff and the current people at the FA who've been making decisions over the last 10 years with regards to women's football. Because on a gradual basis, and I've worked with them up close, you know, I actually hosted the WSL show for about 7 years, which used to go out on BT Sport and ESPN. And what a lot of people don't know is that the FA actually funded that programme. It wasn't BT or ESPN paying for it. They were trying to get it seen, and they've had the Game Changer plan that they had over 5 years, and then they've renewed what they want to do there and achieve. And even when I've had my own frustrations about scheduling in women's football and the fact that I felt like some of the changes that were happening were also a little detrimental to some other areas of the women's game, probably, you know, lower grassroots level. What I see is that more than I ever did is that they had a bigger picture, and things like the tournament that we just had, followed by an Olympics team that we're going to be able to cheer on next year, followed by the year after that, the home Euros that they bid for and won. All of these steps are to make the progress that they need. And then the scheduling, you know, even off the back of the World Cup in France, we're already seeing some changes because, you know, the men's stadiums are opening their doors on the first international weekend this year, which is the 7th and 8th of September. And you've got places like Stamford Bridge opening its doors to help try and promote the game even further. And then the scheduling looks so much better than it did last year, just from what I've seen and glanced at. And this is all things that they've been working towards in baby steps. And what you have to think is it isn't a quick fix. It has to be well thought out and executed. And I put my faith in those people to get it right.
Well, if you put your faith, that's good enough for me. If you're happy with what you see, and obviously, you know, you obviously clearly weren't far closer than certainly than myself, but I think it's incredibly reassuring, you know, to hear your praise for the FA, you know, and you can hear it in your voice, your excitement, you know, about the prospect for the women's game on the back of this World Cup as well. I think, don't you think, Gary? Mm.
Absolutely, mate, and I think there's a nice link there between the in the Men's World Cup in 2018, the way Gareth Southgate organised the team and its the way it was presented to the media and to the fans, it allowed the fans to reconnect with an England team that perhaps had lost that relationship with its fans over the years. And I think the women's team had done a similar... the women's team hadn't lost it. It just wasn't there in the first place to lose. But I think the women's team now has a relationship with the fans. Many fans, and I count myself among those, I knew very little about women's football, but now I'm a passionate supporter of the Lionesses. And, you know, I would massively want them to do well in the future. And I think the success and the way they not only played, but they sort of presented themselves as an England team, it was massively impressive.
They are such impressive individuals, and it's really hard not to buy into them, because I think, as well as the talent that they showed on the pitch, and I think they did prove to a lot of people that, you know, this is a team that can really play football. But away from the pitch, and when they were challenged in those biggest moments, you know, on the pitch against Cameroon, when they really didn't react in any way that I would have found tempting to, and away from disappointment as well, I thought that they were exemplary. And these girls are role models, and they're taking a huge responsibility on their shoulders, because they're being looked at more than any other women footballers before that have gone before them. But I think they're really rising to that challenge, and people want them to win, and people buy into the stories, the individual stories where these girls have come from. This little group in the northeast of England that came through, your Lucy Bronzes, Izzy Christiansen's, Lucy Staniforth's, Jill Scott's, Steph Horton's. There's this little group that came through, and the way that people bought into the class of 92 with Manchester United coming through at Old Trafford. I think there's a lot of that. The people that are close to women's football and know it, they understand that this is quite the journey that this group have come on, certainly the more senior members of the current Lionesses team. And you want them to win something. I mean, Kaz Kani retiring at the tournament, you wanted them to win that bronze medal for her, and it wasn't to be. But I think long-term, all of them are buying into the same thing, and that's the progress of the sport as a whole. And there's young girls and boys watching now who, I mean, things that I've heard since coming back from the tournament, because I was equally in the bubble that they were for a while. And you hear that there's like children in gardens celebrating goals and pretending to be Lucy Bronze. And that's either little boy or little girl, because they got whipped up in that World Cup, and we've then since seen it with netball and the Cricket World Cup in the men's as well. So sport reflects society. I mean, you touched on that, Stuart, when you're talking about students and university and studies. Well, that was something that I did myself when I was at university, was how sport reflects society, and it's so important. And so wherever the message comes from, I think if we can get people to really back the Lionesses for whatever reason it is, it can only be a good thing, because they are such good role models going forward. But, you know, maybe that one day will change. Maybe we'll have a scandal in women's football. I don't know.
That's when you know you've reached, when there's perfect equality in the world.
Just throwing something in there. I was back in, because I live in Spain at the moment, but I was back in the UK a few months ago, and you often see it in World Cups and European Championships, the men's game, the kids' sponsors produce the women's shirts in the men's design. And I saw an advert. I was walking through Birmingham, through Grand Central, in the by the New Street Station in Birmingham, and they were advertising men's versions of the Lionesses shirts. I thought that was fantastic.
It's such a small thing, but actually I'm really pleased that you brought that up, because I think that the kit is one of the things that is reflecting the way that the game's going, because the Lionesses kit, the red away one, which was so popular with yeah, everybody who was out in France, was such a beautiful kit, and it just fit them so well. And then you look back at the WSL now and the new Chelsea shirt that's been promoted. I don't know whether you've seen it.
I'm a Chelsea fan, Lindsay, so I have, yes.
It looks fantastic. And when you've got that quality and you've got that degree of professionalism around it, because it's not just on the pitch, it's from the marketing department down to the board, well, up to the boardroom, and down to the groundsmen and women who are keeping the pitches so brilliantly as well. You can just see that it's everywhere now in the game, and no stone is being left unturned. That's probably the point that I would want to make from it, is that I don't think anything is. I think everything's being addressed.
Yeah.
It's funny, sorry, I know we're sort of chatting about the Lionesses here, and obviously Gary and I chat quite a lot, and it's no secret that sort of my family have no interest in football whatsoever. I am a real outlier, but in terms of the Women's World Cup, I have two daughters, and Megan Rapinoe has just become this almost icon in my house now. You know, she's just someone, and you know, we've just talked about how, you know, sport transcends, you know, and this and this player, this woman, this female has arrived almost in the house and has just captured, you know, the imagination, captured the heart, captured, you know, what she's trying to say. You know, she absolutely entranced, you know, for a month, everybody in the house. And again, that's something that, one, shows the power of sport, but certainly shows the power of, I suppose, of female football and women's football, that it had the power to draw in females who have absolutely no interest in sport, but that she was that powerful. It transcended that.
I think that she's used her platform brilliantly, and she's been a great spokesperson for political issues as well. And she's taken the success that she's had in football and the fact that people are looking to her quite a lot at the moment. And she's used that moment to shine. And it's been brave, and it's been brilliant, actually, to see a female being so revered by everybody. Because I think on social media as well, you pick up these bits and pieces after the World Cup's ended, because you see what she's been doing in America and different. I watched one of the clips where she was addressing hundreds and hundreds of people and could have easily been a politician as easily as she is such a brilliant footballer. But I don't think that's everyone's responsibility. I think it's great that she's taken that mantle and she's decided to use the platform that she's got to speak out. But I don't think there has to be that sort of responsibility on everybody's shoulders. I think she's very natural at it and she uses it well. And occasionally you get these breakthroughs. I mean, not in such a degree, but I mean, if you look at someone like Frank Lampard, who's very articulate, who came through the men's game, who's someone I really like to listen to. I think you always have those figures, different people that you like to hear what they say. You maybe share their thoughts, they speak a bit of sense, and then that has an impact on you. And if that is with your children and in your household, that's so good. But I don't think we need to put extra pressures on these women either.
No, I mean, I absolutely agree. You're right. You know, first and foremost, that they are footballers. They are not, you know, they shouldn't take the weight of the world and the ills on their shoulders. I absolutely agree. It just, like I say, it was just how, you know, we mentioned about it, that just the power to transcend, you know, entire communities and societies just through, you know, through football, through an athlete and through their platform. But, you know, we just talked about the Americans and stuff, and, you know, 11.7 million viewers, I think you mentioned it before, you know, BBC's most watched programme of the year so far. And I think, you know, this free-to-air is so crucial for the women's game as well.
It is, and it's not just crucial for the women's game. I think it's crucial for any minority sport, anything that needs to have that audience out there. I'd even go as far as to argue it's pretty crucial as well for the rest, because as we saw with the Cricket World Cup, when it also got shown on Channel 4, that meant that the viewing figures went up drastically, because put things behind a paywall and then it becomes about something else. It becomes about affordability and not passion for something. And so I would love to see it more and more. But, I mean, obviously, that is not the business end of the market that we're looking at. I appreciate as well that you're always going to have these competitive outlets. My only fear is that the moment that it's getting dissolved so much because of things like Netflix and Amazon Prime and all these other areas. You know, you've got this one being talked about as well, which is going to be an ITV, BBC version, I believe, or some collab going on to sort of rival Netflix. And it's like, well, where does it end? You've got individual club TVs as well. If you're a huge, staunch Spurs fan, then you probably want to sign up for Spurs TV, as you would if you're a Liverpool fan, for Liverpool to get your men's and women's fix, as you would with Chelsea. So we're putting a lot on the consumer here, and when you have that free to air, I think you can see how brilliantly it works. Those sorts of figures would not have been achieved if it had been behind the paywall. I think we all are honest enough to know that. But the fact that it was so accessible and easy for people to get in their own homes got those sorts of figures. And you think that, well, how do you make that work? And surely it's because those numbers you can then back up with sponsors coming on board and taking advantage of it, surely.
Yeah. I don't know if it works across the rest of the world. I live in Spain, and all the games were free to air on Spanish TV. so without a paywall. So I'm not sure what the viewing figures were over here, because obviously Spain were eliminated fairly early. But you know, I'm not sure how that sort of transmits across the rest of the world and across Europe and America. It's interesting that Stu says about he's the sort of the lone football fan in his family. I mean, I'm sitting 2 metres away from my wife, who is a massive Wolves fan, very much like yourself, Lindsay.
She's a good one.
She is. Yeah, she's smiling there. And my wife and my daughter, who's a Man United fan, but let's not talk about that too much. But when we spoke after Lioness had lost, we thought it would be great for the Americans to win because of Meghan. And it almost became a sort of like a cause célèbre afterwards. And they were going to win because they were the best team by a country mile against the Dutch. But so I want to go talk about the Lionesses, though, particularly. And so who were the standout stars? I mean, I've got my own opinions of the standout stars for Lionesses, but it'd be interesting to hear who you thought were the best players for England.
Well, I immediately would say Ellen White, Lucy Bronze, Jill Scott, Jeff Horton. And it's sort of the spine of the team, I think. They were the go-tos. I don't think it's any coincidence as well that most of those played most minutes of the tournament. And I think each of them, in their own right, shone on different occasions, different matches. And I really worry for trying to replace these players because they're that good. I mean, we've got such young talent coming through being nurtured, but I cannot imagine a midfield at the moment without Jill Scott in it doing what she does, or a right back replacing Lucy Bronze in the future. It's really hard to see because they've made those positions their own. And maybe the one that surprised out of those four the most was Ellen White. I mean, I've watched her for some time, and I would have said I would never have ever doubted her work rate and the athleticism she has. If you speak to any of the girls, they'll say that she's like the ultimate pro. But probably in positions gone by, when she was back at Birmingham and other clubs that I've watched at Notts County in different places, I thought that she lacked that sort of killer instinct in front of goal, the clinicalness that she showed in this tournament. And she was also played, you know, as a front number nine. And this isn't a position that she's been used to playing for most of her career, but it's definitely one that she's flourishing in.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I agree with all that you said, but I was not aware of Helen White's history, but she looked like an absolute predator in the penalty area. You know, it's almost, you know, you have these sorts of finishes in the men's game. You know, you go back to Michael Owen, Alan Shearer, Harry Kane. She's almost a one for one. You give her a chance, she's going to bury it. But for me, the standout player was Steph Houghton was absolutely amazing. Not only in a defensive role, and she excelled in that, but also to bring the ball forward and to develop. She's almost like one of my favourite players of all time, Franco Baresi. But she had that ability to defend and then bring forward, great play. Absolutely outstanding performances.
And put everything on the line and lead by example. I mean, she is the perfect captain because, you know, those goal line clearances that we witnessed and her literally making those last-ditch tackles, it is sending out a message to the rest of the team, and it always galvanises them and moves them on again another level. And just when you think that their energy levels are depleting by 10%, she'll go and do something and suddenly they're all back up at 95, you know. And I think that is the effect that she has throughout the team. And, you know, it's also well documented that she's got a lot going on in her personal life as well with her husband at the moment. Yeah. And to be able to put that to one side and put in those sorts of performances was incredible.
Absolutely.
It's funny listening to you. I mean, it's great, you know, discussing players and standout players. And you mentioned one for me. The player of the tournament, Jill Scott. I thought she was she was absolutely phenomenal. Every game, everything seemed to go through her. Everything, she just seemed to be. I know we've talked about Sir Howard being the heartbeat of the team, but for me, Jill Scott just linked everything together. I thought she was absolutely phenomenal. And for me, a player who makes the game look easy is a great player. Mm. And her work rate is phenomenal, and she's incredibly fit, but she made She just makes the game look so easy. And that, for me, is the trademark of a great player. But when you just mentioned there, I mean, she's 32 years old now, and my even concern as the World Cup was going through, and it was, how are they going to replace this girl? You know, how? Yeah. Where's the next Jill Scott going to come from?
I think you're looking at the likes of Ciara Walsh and Georgia Stanway, which we saw little bits of throughout the tournament. I thought Ciara had some brilliant games throughout it, but they don't exactly do the same thing that Jill does. And finding a like-for-like player is so difficult. And I felt that we missed Farrah Williams as well this tournament, who's been such a stalwart for England over the years and played such a... She had an intelligent game, actually, Farrah, if I was to compare. But one of the things that Jill had, as well as this work rate and things flowing through her, which also happened with Farrah, and we managed to get Jill to replace her, so I'm giving us all a bit of reassurance here.
Good, thank you.
Is that Jill also had that ability to break her play the other way. She was turning the ball over and turning what was an England defence into an England attack half the time as well. And I thought though her getting her foot in was just critical for us turning the ball over in midfield. And I did think that we'd get a bit more dominated in midfield than we did. And I think that was mainly down to her.
I thought she was incredible. I thought she was phenomenal all tournament. Obviously, you know, we've looked at the players, we've gone through the players, but it's interesting to note, and I know both teams in the final had female coaches, but there was a lot of male coaches throughout the tournament. And I just wonder what your opinion is of that, or why you think that is.
I think it just comes down to opportunity. I think we're still trying to feed those coaches through the levels to bring them up to the top of the game and encourage them. And once we get them, keep them. There's always going to be those battles with women as well. There's certain things that we can change, you know, gender pay and opportunities and all those sorts of things. But we can't change that if women want to go and have families or whatever else is going on in different people's lives. It's not just women, but that you have different things. It's about that retainment. So once you've got them to a certain level, how do you keep them there? And I would argue that for a lot that have up until now maybe been the front-running coaches in this country, they probably got despondent because of the lack of opportunity at a higher level. So it is about taking... not a gamble, because it would be an educated one, because they're there and they're as qualified as their male counterparts. But I think it's about not being scared to give those opportunities to female candidates as well as male ones. And I mean, we still see that in the game on the men's side. You know, no one has been, if you want inverted brackets, brave enough yet. But these women are out there. These talented coaches are out there. There can be more. And that comes from attracting just from school age, really. You know, if people are wanting to get involved in sports coaching, are we doing enough to bring them through? And I hope that's being addressed at the moment. But from what I hear, there certainly is a lot of talent there. But if you can only get to a certain level and then feel like there's a ceiling, I wonder if that's part of it.
It's difficult to imagine that any sort of young girls who are interested in sport wouldn't have been inspired by the performances of the Lionesses in the World Cup and obviously generally the World Cup, the Women's World Cup, and the great player that went on there. You mentioned about getting girls. Women get opportunities, and Hannah Dingley, is that a name, was recently appointed as academy manager of Forest Green. That's an opening, and you know, I think if the opening will come, I'll rephrase that, when the opening does come, it will probably be in the lower leagues first, and because there'll be that reluctance to sort of cross the Rubicon, which is probably a glass ceiling anyway, to give women a chance. But people like that become a pioneer to break through the barriers and prove themselves as being successful and just as good at coaches. And I forgot the lady's name who managed Chelsea's women, who was
Emma Hayes.
Emma Hayes, massively successful. And I'm sure could manage a men's team just as easily as a women's team, because it's a football match. It's football players. The laws of the game are the same. You know, it can't be that much different. And I'm sure eventually we will see in the not too distant future women managing teams in the Championship and in the Premier League as well. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think it is true. I think we will. I've got every single confidence in that. But what we need to not do is probably more what we should be talking about. And I think what we need to not do is just shine this light constantly when there's a first woman doing something. We all seem to then want to follow every bit of their career. And although that's it can be inspiring for other people if it goes well, there's obviously going to be occasions where this is human nature that it's not always going to go great. And sometimes I think they have a bit too much of the spotlight on them. And I'm trying to think of an example, but the only one that I can sort of think of which relates to my industry is when Jackie Oatley first commentated on Match of the Day, and she turns up to do her first commentary and there's, I don't know, two different cameras pointing at her to do her job. You know, let them do their jobs. Yeah. They don't need to be having all this attention around it. And I think Sian Massey actually as well, who's obviously very talented lineswoman and referee, and I think she was protected from that because I think it started to happen with her after the comments that had happened from Andy Gray and Richard Keys, and then it became very noticeable that she was getting a lot of decisions right, and then people were wanting her to put her forward for more Premier League matches and they held her back, and some people would go, oh, well, why? You know, why not just let her go? She's that good. Why not let her? And I think it's because you have to protect these people to a degree to let them to just get on and do their job, and they don't need that sort of circus around it.
That's a good point. I don't think anybody notices or particularly cares whether Sian Massey is running a line or not, because she's just an assistant referee who does her job with the same efficiency as a male.
Yeah,
and no one takes any notice anymore.
Yeah, not anymore. But I think there was a risk of that happening at one point.
I mean, do you think, Lindsay, listen to what you've just said there, and essentially you're looking for football intelligence, whether that's male or female, it to me is irrelevant. You are looking for football intelligence and the best person to fulfil a role. And it's interesting there that you've just mentioned about not shining the spotlight on the pioneers, if you like. But do you think there is more pressure to be, I know this isn't the correct grammar and I apologise, but do you think there's more pressure to be more right for these females in these particular roles that they're going into?
Yeah. I mean, because that is the only thing. I'm not a professional footballer. I love football. I love watching it. I love being a journalist. But I cannot relate to what it's like, you know, playing in a World Cup. I cannot. But I can relate to being a woman in a very male-dominated area. And just being a football journalist, you feel like you cannot make a mistake. And again, I'll give you another example of that. Is, you know, Chris Kamara on Sky Sports News has made a very good living from getting things wrong, from being a bit of the butt of the joke.
Yeah.
But the time that we can laugh about this properly is when there's a female equivalent, because if a woman did that, if I did that, I wouldn't have worked again. That is the truth, because people go, well, she doesn't know what she's talking about. Now, there's an element of him being a bit jovial and it being a bit of a joke and that he's played football, so clearly he knows about it. But I think it has to be balanced. And if you can't do it with a woman too, then is that really fair? Because we're picking apart, you know, knowledge or perceived knowledge from a lot of people, or women working in the game sometimes, whether it be writers or broadcasters. And those are the sorts of things that I do know about and sometimes have experienced. And it does feel like it's different. It's a different case for the guys than the girls.
Yeah, I guess there is. It's inevitably that, inevitably true that, and it's not fair, and it's not just, and it's things that should disappear, but there's a residue of bias that a lot of people perceive that football isn't something that women should be involved with. I think, I hope he forgives me if I get this wrong, but I think Liam Gallagher once said that women should be involved in football because somebody's got to heat up the pies at half-time. You know, I mean,
or
there's a residue
or something, yeah.
Yeah, there's a residue of that sort of bias going through. And let's hope, I mean, things like the Women's World Cup that we've just witnessed, let's hope those things break in. And people such as your good self and, you know, as you mentioned, Jackie Oatley, who are breaking these barriers down as you go through, and perhaps, and you know, Shaun Massey, as you mentioned earlier. And it's difficult not to focus on these successful women in football, because they should be focused on almost, because they are breaking down these barriers.
And it's nice to see when it's going well that they are held up in that way. I don't know. I think my point coming back to the spotlight thing is it's just that extra pressure, isn't it? That,
yeah, you're
sometimes
right.
You just hope that people can just get on with it. And the fact that we're always having to highlight or talk about or even keep mentioning gender with these things, which we do at the moment, because that's how we're going to get it to change. But the actual triumph will come when we're not having to talk about it at all.
Yeah, it did, right, Lindsay? Just on about extra spotlight. So just want to mention about Nikita Paris and Lucy Bronze are playing for European champions Lyon next season.
Mm.
Lyon, obviously, the dominant club in women's football in Europe. And so will moves such as these boost Lioness's chance of playing, of getting more players at top clubs? Or will it just weaken the domestic game, do you think?
I think it can only be seen as a good thing. If you're playing with the best and you're definitely having these other challenges as well around the game, you know, the fact that they're going to different cultures and having to settle in and perform at the top as well is only going to bring them on as players, and playing, as I've already said, with those like for like best in the world, because that's where you want to be. But if you look at the WSL, you've got players that were out, sort of trying to think, Mary Earps at Wolfsburg, who's now coming back and playing for Manchester United. Toni Duggan, who we don't know where she's going to go, but she's not going to be at Barcelona. She's done that and she's coming back. And then all these players that, you know, Danielle van der Donk and Maren Melder, and, you know, we've had all these different players. We've still got Viviane Miedema as well at Arsenal. We've got all these amazing players in England. So I think Europe across the board is looking really strong. But then I say that, and you see the US League, and I think that still is to be held in high regard. You know, Rachel Daly's gone back out there, is playing already, whilst some of the England girls still have some time off, and I've already seen that she's lighting it up there again. But it can only be good for them to play at the top of their level, and wherever that may be. I would like to see more of the Lionesses playing in England, because the league is so good and it's so tempting, and we're on such a par with the likes of Lyon and all these other teams that this is the place to be. And I think it has been getting there, but I think there are still teams that are a bit further ahead than any of the teams here, and Lyon is definitely one. I mean, that is the equivalent, as we like to do these comparisons in the men's game, of Barcelona or Real Madrid coming calling. Is if Lyon comes knocking in women's football, then you know that's the team that you're probably going to go to.
It's funny that you mentioned Lyon, actually. I think there are four consecutive winners of the Champions League. I mean, to the layman there, that just sounds like a massive gulf. You know, if you have a team that's winning the Champions League four times in a row, you know, that almost dictates. But I think, you know, like you said, I think English clubs are very close, but being close can be runners-up or semi-finalists. But in terms of taking that final step to actually winning the trophy, that can be the biggest step of all. And, you know, and how close, you know, realistically, how close are the English clubs?
Well, if you look at last year's Champions League, then you would say that they're second, well, second or third. I mean, I think that Chelsea getting to the semi-finals showed that an English club can go very far in that competition. But gone are the days where Arsenal used to dominate everything and actually the only team that have actually won the Champions League. I think there's still a long way to go, but I feel like if you put together some of the resources of Arsenal, Manchester City and Chelsea at the moment, you put them all together, you would have a team that would rival Lyon. But
right,
they're not, they're separated. So I think we've probably got a few years to go before we're at that level, but I don't think we're that far away.
Yeah, it's interesting that one of the big in the men's game, one of the big advantages the English game has, the British game has, is the financial dominance. So is money a bit as big a factor in the women's domestic game as it is in the men's?
It's starting to be, yeah, because you've got more agents in the game than ever before, more coming through. You have more sponsor deals and boot deals and all those sorts of things that go with being a great player that will definitely make up your wages, but ultimately you want that central contract to be right. And if you can earn £60,000 a year in one country, but you can earn £260,000 in another, potentially, then, and we know that these deals have been out there in football because Alex Morgan earns such a lot of money. A lot of it does come from endorsements, but Marta has played all over the world and played for big bucks. And if people really want to make that opening, they can. So you can see that the landscape is changing. And I think money will play a bigger part because you only, that's the thing that doesn't change, isn't it? Is that it's a short career. Whether you play men's football, women's football, you can play it whilst you're fit and healthy and for a certain period of time. And then your career is cut short and you've got to either go on and do something else or retrain or try and get another job within football. And those are really difficult. So you have to make hay while the sun shines. And I don't think anyone would deny any of these top players that opportunity to do so.
A comment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's what you're saying about changing landscapes. You know, we're looking at European competition, European club football, and Lyon's dominance and stuff. But I suppose one constant within the game is actually just how good the USA team are consistently. You know, year on year, cycle on cycle, tournament on tournament. You know, you mentioned the women's league in the USA, but why? Well, I suppose this is the magic question or the magic answer, but why are they so consistently good?
Well, the cynic in me would say that that's because the women's team is bigger than the men's team, so they get more of the attention, more of the focus and more of the money. Maybe that has a part to play over there. But that isn't actually the case, is it, with more of the money? Because they're taking them to court at the moment about that, but they should be. And I think the fundamental factor, if I was to put it down to one thing, is belief, the self-belief, the mentality of that team. Because I think that other teams are starting to show that they can match them on the athleticism front, they can match them on the work rate, and they can match them with the tactics. But I think the area that they dominated the most, and they did back it up with talent all over the pitch, which is undeniable. But I think the winning mentality they had, they were not going home with anything less than the gold. But I think there are certain doubts that creep in with other teams, and what you get from success is that you know what it feels like and you've done it before, so you can do it again. And that first one, that first gold, which I hope for England will come at some point, will breed many more, because once you've done it once, you know the formula, you know how it felt. And that's the thing that they've got in abundance. And they're also really held up in such a positive light within society over there. They're not criticised. They're not. I don't think they've shied away over there. From the league has been so professional. They've attracted a lot of great players, and they get the crowds, and so they just play to that.
Yeah, you make some massively good points there, Lindsay. I've always said that, you know, the biggest step in the world is 0 to 1. 1 to 1 million afterwards is like falling off a log. You know, that first one is where you sort of, you know, you sort of shed your preconceptions of being, well, I'm trying to try, and you become a winner. And it's different between going out and hoping to win and going out and expecting to win. But going back to what you're saying about the money issue in the USA, I mean, there's a big dispute going on at the moment between equal pay between the men's and the women's team. I mean, I read reports that the women received a bonus of around $250,000 each for lifting the trophy. And if the men's team had achieved such success, and that, I accept that probably pretty remote, but they would have earned $2.2 million each. Now, A, is that fair? And B, is that going to change very quickly?
Oh, I think it's going to change, because I think they're going to win. I think that this case is just going one direction. And the reason being that if you do an England versus USA model on this, USA, women's football is bigger than men's football. It gets bigger crowds, it gets bigger audiences. I mean, there's been facts throughout the World Cup that have backed that up as well, in terms of it being the most sold football shirt ever. That one that was worn in France by the USA team is the most sold soccer shirt in the US, superseding anything else. So if you take all of those bits, the endorsements, the companies that want to get involved and sponsor, it is higher on the women's side of the game. And so should be the reward. That's how it works here, isn't it? So if we flip it around, the Premier League is the biggest league in the world. So that's why we've got players that are on, you know, over £300,000 a week if they're at the top of the game. And that's why the top of the women's game aren't even on £30,000, £40,000 a year, some of them. So, and the argument that we're told is because it's where demand is, you know, if that's where people are watching, if that's what brands want to back, then that's where the finances are, then that's how it is. But you can't have that one way as an argument for us here, and then over in the States, it doesn't work vice versa, because they actually do boss everything when it comes to the figures and the financial backing and the endorsements and the shirt sales. And so I don't really understand what their argument can possibly be over there for the men getting more.
Yeah, I agree.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, like I said, I don't mean to keep going back to it, but I know when we were chatting on the car seat that I do, and, you know, we were saying that it's not so much that women's football in America has no competition, but you look at the four dominant sports, male team sports in America, and football doesn't feature in those. And so, you know, it's almost like, you know, women's football is, you know, is probably the number one female sport over there, and they've certainly managed to take advantage of that. Whereas, you know, you bring it back to this country, and, you know, and potentially this might be the, I don't know if it is, but potentially the problem in Argentina, whereby because the men's game is so dominant that the female game seems to take a bit of a back seat, whereas in America it's almost got this free run because of baseball, basketball, NFL and hockey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then should the comparison be between the women's soccer team and the men's baseball team then, or the men's NFL team? Because are they more on the level playing field? Is that the sort of money they should be getting?
For me, yeah. I think if you are the preeminent sport, and in, like you say, you know, the money that it brings in, the success that it brings, the revenue, the marketing, then remuneration should match that. I absolutely agree.
Mm. I think the problem is the issue in let's sort of look at football as a standalone issue there, that the USA men's team, if they won the World Cup, they would each get $2.2 million. The women who have won the World Cup got $250,000 each. Mm. Now, we're not talking about competitive baseball or competitive with NFL or the NBA. In football, still, the men are massively rewarded more than the women are.
And also the argument and the discussion isn't even whether they should get equal. They should be getting more because
absolutely.
Of their reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. Do you, like I say, I suppose, do you think, you know, like you've talked about with this momentum that's happening in America, do you think the rest of the football world are waiting to see how this plays out before looking at themselves internally, or do you think that other countries will push forward with this as well with regards to pay?
Well, I think when you talk about the smaller nations and the potential for the World Cup to open up to more teams in the future, then those smaller nations are a little bit probably beside themselves, because if they give a bit of opportunity, but then you have landmark potential cases like this one that says actually that isn't enough, we now want equality or further, depending on what your viewing figures end up being, they might be a little petrified at that, because you're opening a door which needs to be opened and should have been opened a long time ago. But financially, it's whether they can support it, isn't it? So I imagine there's a little bit of fear as well watching, because people are going to realize, well, are our pockets deep enough?
I think that's a great point. There's always a problem we have with these podcasts, and this is a classic example. We could go on talking for ages, but obviously time's an issue for us. So I want to just ask you a question. If you could have one wish for women's football, and particularly in England, with Lionesses or with English club football, 10 years down the road, where would they be?
Can I have my Aladdin moment and ask for a couple?
Of course you can. Of course you can.
You have to come back on the podcast, though.
The only reason I want to do that is I want to talk about the game as a whole, but I'd love to make a wish as well just for England, just because I've watched this team, I've become so fond of them. So I'll start with that one because it's really easy, is I want England to win gold, because I'm a huge believer that success, and that success will only come. I think the next game-changing moment in women's football in this country is only going to come when we win something. I think people will applaud and they will support and they will watch us get to a bronze or a silver, but I think a gold will change it. It will do the next thing. So I wish for us to win gold, whether it be at the home Euros or whether it be at the next World Cup or whether it be Olympic gold. But I would just like to see a gold medal coming back here for those girls, because they really have won the hearts and minds of us all. But the game as a whole, I want to see more financial backing around the world. That's starting with the FAs and the governing bodies that can really help propel women forward in other countries, through to the leagues around the world that need to be more competitive and need to attract women in the same way that men's football teams do around the world as well. It would be great to see more sponsors, more endorsements, more marketing, all of those things that I think the visibility of the game could improve so much. So that all comes back to the financial backing, and that's what I would like to see more of around the world.
Okay, that's a great answer. I don't know how many other football fans would agree with what I'm going to say now, but for me, I've always sort of looked at women's football as interesting, but not sort of with the same passion I look at men's football. But the Women's World Cup in 2017, in this year, really sort of has crystallised the sport for me. So I will be following the Chelsea women's team with as much passion as I'll be following the Chelsea men's team going forward. And I absolutely will be. And I think, you know, and I think the important thing about recognising the quality of women's football is it's not compared to the men's football. It's different. And it's just not worse or better, it's just different. And they both have a quality of their own. And I've recognised that. So I've learned from the Women's World Cup this year.
And I bet another thing has happened, which is what I spotted with my family and friends that are sort of interested from afar, you know, like to see England do well, but in anything, and didn't really buy into it that much. My own mum didn't like me playing football, and she was watching all the matches. So there's loads of things that have changed. And the other thing is the names that people now know. You know, when I first started in women's football, the two players that everybody would say to me is that I know Kelly Smith and I know Faye White. But they would really struggle to name any others. And then this World Cup, I came home and people were saying, oh, did you get to meet Ciara Walsh? Did you get to meet Demi Stokes? And all these different players. And what are they like? What's Karen Bardsley like? I cannot get over that. And so that will be brilliant to see that these talented athletes become household names. That's the other thing.
Absolutely right, Lindsay. Couldn't agree more, Steve.
Like I say, the main reason why I signed up to do these podcasts is because I get to talk to interesting people who know far more than I do. And probably the greatest compliment that I could talk to you all night about this. I have so many questions and so many. There are so many things I want to talk about, and so many more things that I want to know. And listening to your passion and, you know, you're being an advocate for women's football. I'm right there. I'm right there with you in terms of, you know, advocating the women's game. You know, like Gary said, it just feels. I mean, I felt it in my own house, like you've just mentioned there, Lindsay. And it just feels like this summer has just been almost a monumental shift in women's football. And I think, you know, we talked about the players maybe not putting too much responsibility on them. But I think probably responsibility certainly lies within us and within myself to make sure that it's not, oh, well, yeah, it was a great summer and thanks very much, but that it's, you know, the women's game is, you know, is promoted and pushed, you know, whenever and wherever. Like I say, you know, even down to a college program, you know, we've got four girls already on the program for next year, which is, you know, which is brilliant. And it's that, you know, it's almost wherever responsibility can be taken, I think we need to take responsibility to promote the game.
Yeah, stay there, stay with it. And we can talk again around the Olympics, around the home Euros, and we'll keep it going.
Brilliant. Brilliant, brilliant. Lindsay, all I can say is thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much. Thanks so much for having me on and for also giving this all the debate and highlighting it as much as we have. It's great to do.
No problem. No problem. Gary?
Bless you, Lindsay. It's been an absolute joy. And thanks, too. I mean, this has been a real sort of different podcast for us, these Football Times. But I promise, Lindsay, this will not be the last time we talk about women's football at these Football Times on the Lob. And it'd be great to invite you back again somewhere down the road to talk about how things have changed and progressed since.
Yeah, you're going to have to change it to these Football Times are changing.
God bless you.
Brilliant. Well, thanks ever so much. All that's left for me to say is thank you very much for listening, and please join us again next time on the Lob podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.